Number 88515, Sable Communications of California versus FCC, and 88525, Federal Communications Commission versus Sable. Mr. Taranto.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. These cases involve facial challenges to the constitutionality of Congress's 1988 legislation aimed at commercial telephone pornography. Section 223B of the Communications Act of 1934, as it was amended in 1988, prohibits any person from making any obscene or indecent interstate telephone communication for commercial purposes. Sable challenged both the obscenity and indecency prohibitions on their face. The District Court, on a motion for preliminary injunction, held the obscenity prohibition valid and the indecency prohibition invalid. Our position is that both challenges should have been rejected. As to obscenity, which is not protected by the First Amendment, the short answer to Sable's objections concerning how the statute is to be applied is that they are insufficient to support a facial challenge because the statute plainly is capable of constitutional application. As to indecency, the statute is justified by a distinctive combination of factors similar to those relied on in the broadcasting context in Pacifica: the accessibility of the telephone medium to children, the compelling governmental interest in preventing children, especially younger children, from hearing patently offensive sexual speech, especially in the privacy of the home, the reasonable congressional judgment that no lesser measure would reliably prevent children's access, and the availability of alternative sources of such speech for adults who wish to obtain it.
Mr. Taranto, do we know which is which here? I mean, of the calls that are really the money-making part of this operation, is it your view that they come within the obscenity provision?
We don't have any kind of statistical breakdown of...
Well, how would one judge? I mean, let's say that the calls that consists of a woman describing sexual activity, would you consider that to be obscene or just a good healthy interest in sex?
Well, it would depend on exactly what was said. The indecency definition is essentially one part of the three-part Miller definition for obscenity. Well, the material need not have prurient appeal in the specific sense that's required for obscenity, and it may well have some literary, artistic, scientific, or political value, although this kind of pornographic material, I think, certainly does not meet the last of those criteria. But the prurient appeal definition that this court elaborated in Brockett against Spokane, we think, narrows the range of even sexually explicit material that is covered by obscenity. So it is entirely possible that there is a fair volume of indecent material that would not rise to the level of obscenity because the prurient appeal definition of Brockett might not be met. But the short answer to your question about the factual record is that we simply don't know of the millions, indeed tens of millions of calls made each year, what percentage of those would be obscene, what percentage would be indecent, and what percentage would be neither obscene nor indecent.
May I just be sure of one point? Are either of these terms defined in the statute?
No, not in the statute itself, but...
How do we know what Congress meant them to mean?
Well, we think that the legislative history makes it quite clear that Congress was looking at both Miller and at Pacifica when it was using those terms. There are various memoranda of law in the congressional record, and I don't think it...
Is there anything in any of the committee reports that describes this point?
There are no committee reports for this.
How deep into the legislative history must we go to find this out? A memorandum of law prepared by whom?
It was prepared by, I think, Citizens for Decency through law and put into the congressional record by the principal.
We presume
sponsors
that Congress adopted the views of that particular group?
Well, I think that is a fair assumption in this case because all of the sponsors of the legislation repeatedly referred to both the memorandum and to Pacifica. And to Miller, there was, as far as I'm aware, no dispute.
Referred in what kind of context? In the debates on the floor?
Yes, in the debates on the floor. The bills that became this law did not make it through committee. They were introduced as amendments They were introduced on the floor and voted on the floor in the House separately and then as an amendment to a larger education bill. But there was no disputing within Congress what the definition of indecency was. Was
really no discussion, I suppose, then, or just a sort of an adoption of those. But we do, it is clear we must look to legislative history to find out what these terms mean.
Well, even without legislative history, it seems to me the fairest assumption when Congress uses the term indecency is to look to what this court had said, and this court's case on indecency is Pacifica. And there, both the commission in that case and in numerous subsequent administrative proceedings has adhered to a standard definition of patently offensive sexual speech. Now, I would like to explain the background of Section 223B because that background is important to understanding both the aims of the statute and why the statute is no broader than necessary to achieve those aims. The telephone pornography industry was born in 1983. As a result of newly available technology, providers of pre-recorded sexually explicit messages like Sable could disseminate those messages on special 976 lines to thousands of callers simultaneously and to hundreds of thousands of callers a day. The providers of this so-called dial-a-porn use the telephone companies to do their billing. The telephone company collects a special charge per minute or per call and pays the provider a share. The market for sexual telephone messages grew rapidly. In 1984, 180 million calls were made to dial-a-porn in New York alone. By 1988, the industry was estimated to gross more than $2 billion a year.
Mr. Toronto, under law, are the telephone companies required to accept these people as customers, or is it a voluntary contractual arrangement?
It is my understanding that each of the telephone companies is, as part of its non-discrimination obligation, required to accept these. But I can't say with certainty whether that's so in each state. I know of no state in which a telephone company has refused to accept these and has been upheld in doing so. From the beginning of this new industry, it was clear that children had ready access to dial-a-porn and that the messages contained a wide range of graphic descriptions of sexual acts, many of those acts involving minors. In 1983, Congress enacted the first version of Section 223B to attack the problem. The statute banned obscene and indecent commercial telephone communications to minors. It directed the FCC to devise regulations that would try to separate adults from minors in the calling audience. And it provided that compliance with such regulations would be a defense under the statute. The FCC then undertook a four-year effort to promulgate regulations that would accommodate Congress's competing goals, to try to prevent access by minors while not unduly restricting adults' access to dial-a-porn. The Commission first proposed a defense based either on use of a credit card to pay for the call, which was not feasible for pre-recorded telephone messages, or on restriction of the messages to evening and nighttime hours. In a challenge brought by Sable's affiliate, Carlin, the Second Circuit invalidated the time of day restriction as essentially ineffective, noting how little time it took for a minor to make a call and the availability of dial-a-porn by long-distance calls to other time zones. On remand, the Commission added a second defense based on the dial-a-porn providers requiring callers to punch in an access code to hear the message. Based on comments from Carlin and others, Carlin in fact stated, children intent on acquiring a code will certainly be able to do so. The Commission recognized the problem that minors might obtain access codes, and the Commission therefore required that access codes be made available only through the mail and canceled upon notification of improper use. In the same proceeding, the Commission also rejected various kinds of blocking as technologically infeasible, unduly expensive, over-inclusive in their impact on non-sexual 976 telephone messages, and ineffective in preventing minors' access. After another court challenge by Sable's affiliate and another remand from that challenge, the Commission promulgated a third set of regulations, adding a third defense based on the provider's scrambling of its messages. Once scrambled, the message could be descrambled by a simple $15 to $20 pocket watch-sized device held up to or attached to the earpiece on the phone. Again, based on comments submitted in the administrative proceeding and reiterated by Sable in its challenge in the Second Circuit, the Commission recognized that minors might be able to obtain descramblers, as it previously recognized with respect to access codes. In the end, though, the Commission came to rest on the three defenses requiring credit card payment, access codes, or scrambling as the best available implementation.
And, Mr. Toronto, didn't the FCC conclude that a scheme using access codes, scrambling, and credit card payment was a feasible and effective way to serve the state's compelling interest in protecting children from exposure to these calls?
I think that the Commission was operating throughout that four-year period not with a single-minded mandate to prevent minors' access.
But didn't it reach that conclusion? Did I state it fairly?
I'm not sure exactly what quote you're referring to.
It was feasible and effective using those things to meet the state's compelling interest in protecting children.
I believe that the Commission was stating a conclusion about the effectiveness of reaching an inherently compromised goal, a goal that said, keep children out, but make sure adults can continue to gain access to the material. And I think all of its rulings in the first, second, and third reports in order need to be read with that goal in mind. The Commission was not looking for the single most effective method of keeping children, of preventing unsupervised access by children. It always had in mind the competing congressional goal of ensuring that adults could continue to have access. So it may well be that the Commission did at various points state, at least with respect to credit cards, although there it was talking only about live calls, that would be an effective way of preventing children's access.
Well, I think that's a concern. If the agency itself concluded that some more restrictive means of controlling this is feasible and effective, I wonder how the total ban survives our constitutional test of least restrictive means.
Again, I think that the Commission was drawing a conclusion about effectiveness as to an inherently limited goal. And indeed, the Commission recognized in each of its three proceedings, based on comments by Carlin and Sable and the telephone companies, that there were significant loopholes in each of the options. Credit cards, it didn't.
Well, you say inherently limited goal. It's limited by the compelling interest that the state itself hypothesizes at the outset.
No, I think it was the goal was limited by the dual congressional command in 1983. Keep this material available on the phones to adults, but try to keep children from gaining access. As long as one had the first part of the congressional command in place, it was never the Commission's focus to look for effective technological alternatives only to get at the second goal, because Congress, it understood Congress to say, don't do anything unduly to restrict adults' access. And I think it's in that against that background that really all of the Commission's conclusions need to be understood.
Well, and I suppose it's more than just a congressional concern. It may be founded, indeed, on a constitutional requirement that adult access be considered.
Yeah, there is. We have not disputed, and Congress itself did not differ with the conclusion that non-obscene speech is within the protection of the First Amendment. And there is no doubt that this ban has an impact on adults' access to
So we
to
do have to make the inquiry about whether this is narrowly tailored and the least restrictive method?
Well, we have argued that that this statute does, in fact, meet that standard. Under at least the plurality opinion in Pacifica, it may well be that some laxer standard may be appropriate. Now, we have not pressed that standard.
Pacifica was certainly not a case that can be read to authorize a blanket ban.
No,
in a criminal context.
Pacifica does not go that far. Pacifica noted the limits on its opinion. Pacifica, however, also did not say that it was going this far and no further. It said that given the distinctive problems concerning broadcasting, the access of children, the pervasiveness of it, the inability to separate adults from children within the audience, that the particular measure before it was justified. What we are asking today is for this court to uphold this telephone indecency ban based on the same considerations that led the court in Pacifica to uphold what was concededly a more limited measure in that case.
Well, just before we leave this, and beginning at Justice O'Connor's initial inquiry, can we interpret this record fairly as saying that the administrative agency made a determination that blocking and access codes were reasonably effective to deter use by minors?
I don't mean to evade that. It depends what one means by reasonably effective. Again, the commission, every time it stated a conclusion about effectiveness, had in mind effectiveness concerning a dual goal, two pieces of a congressional command that were intended.
I'm talking about the one goal of limiting access for minors as to indecent messages.
No, I don't think that the commission's conclusions as a whole can be taken to establish the proposition that children would all but be kept from gaining unsupervised.
You think the commission did, though, decide they've done as well as they could?
Yes, I think the commission did do that.
And even if they thought that was reasonably effective, as Justice Kennedy says, Congress apparently disagreed with them.
Well, I'm not sure Congress disagreed with.
I mean, they would
conclusion. If you read the commission's conclusion that way, then Congress did disagree.
And if they said this is, and if they said, well, this is as well as we can do.
That's not good enough.
Congress said it wasn't good enough.
Yes, I think that would be one reading of the record.
Mr. Toronto, let's talk about if the child protection portion of it is no good. You concede that the whole thing's bad then?
The child protection purpose?
Yes, let's assume that child protection purpose is not served or could be served in a different fashion.
We have not defended, and Congress, I don't think, even enacted the statute on any ground except the prevention of unsupervised access.
That's the only ground on which we can uphold it.
Well, now, that part of the statute.
The indecency part of the statute. That's correct. Not the obscenity. The obscenity part is different. But as to the indecency, we have not suggested that the statute can be upheld.
Does the text
on the
of the statute say that that's the only basis for the indecency portion?
No, the text of the statute doesn't contain a statement of purpose.
See, what affects me is what you say about whether phone companies have to carry this stuff. We're talking here about pornography that is just short of obscenity. And in the ordinary world, responsible individuals can exercise judgment about whether they want to lower the tone of society by making that material available to adults or to children. The local grocery store, even the local broadcaster, because they are not common carriers. But here you're talking about a government that imposes an obligation to carry this stuff nationwide, and there is no individual that can exercise the judgment to say this is not the kind of thing that ought to be generally available in the community.
Well,
instead of just down in one sector by zoning or something of that sort. Don't you think that makes it quite different from some other areas of whether pornography can generally be available?
The measure before this court doesn't impose that obligation. I understood your question to be whether this particular measure could be justified, whatever other statutes are on the books, by...
This measure applies only to common carriers, doesn't it?
Well, this measure applies to the message providers themselves. This statute doesn't speak directly to the common carrier.
Yes, but the message provider is providing the message on common carrier facilities.
That's right.
Who must carry it so that there is nobody who has any say as to whether that goes into every community in the country, indeed into every home in the country.
Well, if there is a concern...
If they have a public service obligation, the common carriers.
Perhaps another statute could relieve common carriers of that obligation. This statute simply prohibits the message providers from disseminating this information. And we have not defended that statute on the ground that adults, that it's justified as a means of somehow protecting adults, because adults do, after all, have the presumed capacity to decide whether they want to pick up the phone and call. What's different about children is that Congress can quite legitimately say even a voluntary call by a minor is not something that we want to turn a blind eye to.
Adults have the capacity to turn off a television set, too, but most broadcasters and most sponsors who have the power to make the judgment about whether they're going to carry pornography just short of obscenity won't do it. So there is somebody other than the man who's making money on it who can control it. And you're telling me this is a situation where, as far as you know, there isn't anybody under current law.
That is true as far as I know under current law. That, I think, is a problem that, if I'm right about what current law is, might well be addressable in another statute.
May I ask to follow up on Justice O'Connor's inquiry earlier about the Commission's conclusion about what could reasonably prevent access by minors? I think when you, in your phrasing of the point, you said that there was no way that you could reliably prevent access by minors. You used a little different word. How many minors are we concerned about? If just a handful get access, is that enough to defend the statute, or do you have to have a substantial segment? And when is a minor? At what age?
Well, it would certainly be a harder case if the facts presented were a choice between a ban that made sure no minors got access and a handful. I think we would then have questions like those that arose in various time, place, and manner cases, like Community for Creative Nonviolence, where the question was just how far can the Park Service go in keeping a park, preserving a park for specified uses. This record, I think, quite amply justifies the conclusion that we don't have a choice between a near perfect and a perfect measure. The ability to gain a credit card number, to gain an access code, to gain
those abilities are probably for the older minors. The very young minors would probably work quite well as to. And I guess as they get closer to majority, they're also more able to figure out ways to get access to this stuff.
I think that is certainly true. That the older minors get, the more resourceful they can get, the more freedom they have. The more time they have unsupervised.
What are the purposes of this? What do we mean by minor in your? And what did Congress identify the age that they were talking about?
No, because
under 21 or under.
Well, in the 1983 statute, Congress did use the term minor, and I assume used it in the normal sense of 18 or under. In the current statute, there's no reference to minors. The question is, we're talking about minors because of the congressional concern. That concern surely is of diminished force as we were talking about 17-year-olds. But children from 5, 6, 8,
those
10
children
have access to telephones and know how to use them.
Access to telephones, but they probably couldn't master these, they couldn't evade the restrictions as easily, I wouldn't think.
Well, not as easily, but I think that children of age 10 or 11, as indeed the anecdotal evidence submitted to Congress and the Commission show, have shown a very strong interest in calling up these dial-a-porn services and getting a 3 or 4-digit access code or getting a credit card number or picking up a small descrambler that just needs to be held up to the earpiece of a telephone is, we think, not a very difficult measure for children. And indeed, Sable and its affiliates have, throughout the administrative proceedings, urge the proposition that these measures are, in fact, ineffective, that children would be able to easily circumvent all of these measures. So we think that it was well within Congress's usual range of fact-finding discretion to determine that the loopholes left by various technological alternatives were very substantial loopholes, and that we weren't just talking about a handful of minors monthly or annually who would be able to gain access, but a very significant number.
Is that number just based on anecdotal evidence, or are there any studies in the record that tell us?
There are no studies. One reason I suspect is that the most obvious means of gaining statistical information would be a survey, and in part because of embarrassment and other factors, that might be very unreliable information. There have, over the years, been hundreds and hundreds of complaints made informal and formal to the commission, to state agencies, to members of Congress.
But those, I suppose, include complaints by adults who wouldn't want the material disseminated to adults either.
No, I'm referring to adults complaining about their children's access. Let me say one quick word about the obscenity portion of the case.
Including an amicus here whose daughter was raped by a 12-year-old after he had talked on the phone for 2.5 hours to one of these.
Yes, there are some extremely lurid consequences of this telephone pornography. Let me just say one word about the obscenity challenge. We think it is a sufficient answer that this is a facial challenge, and that Sable's objection to the obscenity portion is not that obscenity is protected, but that speech that is not obscene in Los Angeles might be disseminated in some other community where it is obscene. It is a sufficient answer, I think, to that challenge, just to note that the statute is clearly capable of constitutional application, a prosecution in Los Angeles, even under Sable's view of the statute, and that no other party is differently situated. And so under Taxpayers for Vincent and other cases, there is no third-party overbreadth claim here. Any challenge that Sable has regarding the obscenity portion should and must be raised only in an as-applied challenge. I'd like to preserve the balance of my time.
Very well, Mr. Toronto. Mr. Tribe?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, let me begin with a question that you, Mr. Chief Justice, asked Mr. Toronto, and with Justice Scalia's follow-up concern, because until now, this case has been litigated in terms of the interest of children. But I do understand the question, mightn't Congress have had, or mightn't this court in hindsight attribute to Congress, another legitimate purpose, protecting common carriers from the distasteful obligation of carrying messages that in some cases, as Justice Scalia suggests, are just short of obscene, although in other cases, as with many of the portions of the Carlin tape, are probably far short of obscene. That interest is an important one, I think, to examine, even if Congress didn't have it in mind, though I wouldn't concede that it would be appropriate to uphold the law on that basis. Fact is that most courts have not treated the telephone companies in this context as common carriers. Pacific Bell has debated whether it will carry these messages. For the time being, it does. Mountain State said no, and the Ninth Circuit, in an opinion by Judge Sneed, in Carlin Communication against Mountain States, said that when you have these messages that can reach lots of people at once, the phone company doesn't have to be treated as a common carrier. It declined to construe state law as requiring that pornographic messages, even lawful ones, be carried. Southern Bell similarly refused, and the Fifth Circuit said that it didn't have to carry them, and both circuits said there was no state action. So the premise that Mr. Toronto has that perhaps Congress might be upheld on another ground, I think just can't be sustained. So we do have to focus on children.
Have there been decisions in other circuits that came out differently from either the Fifth or the Ninth Circuit, Mr. Chief
Chief Justice, I don't think so. So far, every circuit has said these are not common carriers with this general obligation.
Does your client take a position that the telephone companies are common carriers that must be required?
I think to carry the affiliate these of Sable has argued for that position in other cases, but the client I represent here does not take any position on that matter in this case. I really don't have a view. I do think that there's
a
powerful...
You have no view on whether the telephone companies can refuse to carry these?
Oh, I'm inclined to think that they can refuse unless there is some governmental pressure upon them, in which case it's tantamount to a governmental ban. Indeed, Judge Sneed did take the position that when they refuse under threat of prosecution, then the First Amendment comes into play. And that, of course, is the focus of our case today.
But are we talking the long lines companies or just the local companies?
We're talking about the Baby Bells and the other local companies. As to the long line companies, of course, if the locals refused to carry, there'd be nothing to connect.
Sure.
But I suspect a similar proposition would be advanced with respect to the long line companies. Mm-hmm.
But we can say that it's not settled, either from the standpoint of the policy of your client or by a definitive decision of this court, that the carrier is not going to be told that it's required to carry the messages.
Not absolutely and authoritatively settled, Justice Kennedy, but I think implausible to sustain this law on that ground. First, because it's likely they wouldn't be so required. Second, because that wasn't one of Congress's reasons. Third, because even if there is some such requirement, that requirement is purely a product of state law, and for this court to uphold a law that outright bans and criminalizes concededly protected speech in order to hypothetically protect some possible potential common carriers from a state law obligation seems something of a stretch. The real issue here, I think, is children. And whenever a category...
Before we leave that, would it be constitutional for Congress to pass a statute saying that common carriers can refuse to carry any commercial message they choose?
That's an intriguing question, Justice Kennedy. I suppose if there were something of a monopoly and the impact of that law was to prevent certain persons from getting protected messages somewhere, it would be a little like Marsh v. Alabama, in which this court held that a private company cannot, in effect, be authorized by state law to block access of a whole group of people to a protected message. But that would be a difficult issue for another day, I think.
And if that statute is not constitutional, then we are right back to this question, because the next question could be, would a statute be permissible allowing the option to the company to refuse indecent?
Well, in any event, that would surely be a less restrictive alternative for Congress. That is, if Congress were to say that a company may refuse to carry certain kinds of messages, and in that way were to try to relieve them of the burden, the adverse impact on protected speech by message providers would be considerably less, because it would depend on a later adjudication of whether that law was valid. With respect to children, I think the important and quite universally recognized point, and we certainly have to concede it, is that when a category of speech is protected for adults but might harm children, there are not many ways that government can absolutely rule out any possible child access. There are three broad approaches government can take. It can try to channel or zone the speech into times and places where parents can supervise exposure. This court authorized, for example, banning the sale of adult magazines, even not quite obscene ones, to minors in Ginsburg, in Pacifica. Although it certainly didn't authorize outright criminalization, it said that one could take a radio station's careless daytime broadcast of dirty words into account in the licensing context. One could rely, as this court said one had to in Bolger, on parents to intercept potentially indecent condom ads at the mailbox. That's one approach. Now, a second approach is to screen. That is, one can require that the speech, which is unsuitable for children, be coded or scrambled or otherwise made accessible only to people who have some special information or device, and then one can make it illegal for minors to obtain that device. You could require locked boxes on cable TV, and of course there is the FCC's 1987 approach. Now, these two approaches aren't perfect. Children are not chained to their parents. Parents may be busy or distracted. Kids can go next door. All locks and codes can be broken by someone enterprising enough. And so it's tempting sometimes to take the next step and to ban the speech outright by criminal law so that not even willing adults can get it, which is the approach of this statute.
Well, unless you want to say this approach is like the first approach, it says you can do it, but not in this place. That is, not on these common carrier lines. You can do it by cassettes. You can do it by other modes, just not by by telephone. Why is that different in kind from the first approach?
I think the search for that kind of limiting principle is important because I think, as your question recognizes, otherwise the government could use a flat ban to reduce the messages reachable by phone to those that are fit for children. The same rationale, namely some kid will get through, could be used to eliminate the sale of indecent but not obscene books, magazines, films, videos, HBOs, and the like. Indeed, much of what is here described as just short of obscene is not distinguishable from a lot of what's in R-rated movies and lots of racy novels. So it is important to ask whether there is something distinctive about dialing a phone that would justify this content-based law, which is certainly not narrowly tailored. I mean, after all, most of what it outlaws is an adult deliberately dialing a call, not being harassed by anyone. And so let me turn to that.
About the fact that it's in my home, for one thing. I can keep my kids out of the movie, but I can't keep them out of my home. And the phone's right there whenever
the phone is right in your home, as is the mailbox. Mm-hmm. And if you don't want the kids, as I certainly wouldn't want them, to dial these companies from my phone, I wouldn't buy a descrambler. And the FCC takes that into account when it says we do want to empower parents in their homes to disarm the telephone, make it not a vehicle for getting this kind of indecent speech. But this is not a medium, call it common carrier or anything else, that is somehow directed or dedicated to minors, as in a public school PA system or an educational channel. And
describe what is a blocking device?
Well, there are three versions of it. There is a central access blocking technique, which uses the computers within the phone system and which is now becoming feasible just about every place. There is a device that can be attached to the phone in which the default position is the message can get through, but then if you block, the message can't. And there is a descrambler, which is what the FCC in 1987 advocated as the thing making it
feasible.
Well,
the FCC never relied on the use of blocking devices.
No, it did not. It relied instead.
Has the technology changed since then so that that is now feasible?
It seems to have advanced, although the record in this case doesn't tell us. The FCC did say last April in Carlin 3 that the combination of access codes required prepayment by credit card and scrambled messages so that the default position is that the indecent message can't get through unless the parent wants it to get through, that combination was, as you indicated, Justice O'Connor, a reasonable, feasible, and effective way.
Does Sable agree with that position?
That it's reasonably feasible and effective, absolutely.
And does it agree that it's a legitimate regulation?
The decision in Carlin 3 raised one question about that I think I ought in candor to focus on, and that is the Second Circuit in Carlin 3 suggested that it is legitimate unless and until even less restrictive alternatives become available. And they were talking primarily about a beep tone approach under which the default position would be that the message could get through unless the parent installed for $5 or so, and that is now feasible, I understand, a beep tone device in the phone so that it wouldn't get through. But it seems to me that the combination, I don't think one should get distracted with the technological wizardry of all this. The fundamental proposition is that there is nothing distinctive about phones. If anything, it cuts the other way. It's much easier to police the phone either in your own house or in a neighbor's house than it is to police kid looking in somebody else's closet for old copies of Playboy or old centerfolds or turning on the HBO. At least some parent is going to have a monthly bill from Sable or Carlin, actually from the phone company, indicating use of a service by Sable or Carlin. So there is a policing mechanism. Justice Scalia...
I'm still not sure the answer. Does Sable agree that some or all of these devices in combination are legitimate?
Yes, certainly as less restrictive alternatives than a flat ban. It agrees that they are legitimate unless and until a less restrictive alternative still becomes available. But certainly their availability makes this flat ban illegitimate. Let me return to Justice Scalia's question about the rape of that 12-year-old. Some of the stuff which is either obscene or not obscene in any medium might be associated with terrible, terrible tragedy. That isn't, I think, denied. The question really is, can one, as a result, in dealing with non-obscene material, which the government admits is protected for adults, wipe it out from the whole medium on the theory that it's somehow distinctive? The fact is, if you can do it to the telephone, you can do it to pictures of nudity or violence that are not suitable for minors, that might give them terrible ideas, but that are protected for adults. They can be every bit as tempting and corrupting for children, both in print and on film. There are other suggestions the government makes for somehow trying to limit the precedent that I think it realizes could be terribly dangerous. They suggest repeatedly in their brief that what's distinctive about the phone in your home, to which you refer, Justice Scalia, is that it is somehow immune to control for age at the point of sale. That is, unlike the neighborhood magazine store or the neighborhood movie theater where there's somebody in the window and where, unless you're pretty close to 18, you can't very well pass for 18, though you can sneak in. The government says that there's no live vendor at the telephone, and therefore no check at the point of sale. And therefore it's distinctive, and we could therefore justify a sort of limited ruling saying that on the telephone you can reduce adults to what is suitable for minors. I think that that's quite a canard. I mean, the fact is that the FCC's safeguards, the combination of requiring a credit card or an access code or scrambling the message, would interpose live vendors. When you go to get the credit card or the access code or the descrambler, the picture of the world that is painted by the government in its brief is that these children are so enterprising, they can steal their parents' credit cards, they can sneak into some place and buy this descrambling device, but somehow, despite that, they're not going to manage to see the same thing on adult magazine, in adult magazines or somewhere else. The fact is you have to buy an adult magazine even to get the telephone number of one of these companies. So the idea that the absence of a live vendor is decisive, I think, is fallacious. It's especially fallacious since the government's own argument shows that the harm comes not from the purchase, but from the peak. The harm is exposure. It doesn't matter who bought it. If the child goes across the street and looks at the centerfold at the age of 5 or 6, or reads some dirty jokes, that can be disruptive of development in exactly the same way. The issue, therefore, has nothing to do with the vendor. It has to do with the parent. And are we going to have government basically displace parents because parents are not perfect?
But what about the impact on the child? The printed word is less likely to be attractive and harmful. Pictures more so, the live human voice, it would seem to me, more so still. And I'm sure right around the corner with fiber optics is these services with video on telephone lines. Is there no distinction that can be based upon the degree of harm that even letting a few children slip under the wire can cause?
I think there are 2 points, Justice Scalia. The first is that no system will prevent some slippage under the wire unless we take the draconian step of completely blanking out protected speech.
I agree with that, I think.
Second proposition, however, is that this is not a live voice. The government makes a special point of saying that live two-way conversations have nothing to do with this case. This is a recorded voice. It's an answering machine. And certainly a tape or a record or a video...
That's still better than the printed word, I would think.
Well,
as far as its impact upon...
But does it matter whether it comes into your ear through the telephone or through the air in front of you when you put it on a record player or a tape recording? Are we now going to say, as would follow from that question, I think, that if a record or a tape contains suggestive or salacious language or is somehow erotic, though not obscene, and certainly would be disruptive for a 5-year-old or a 10-year-old to hear, that we can't sell it? Because if you sell it down the street, some 15-year-old may buy it, and the 5-year-old may borrow it. It seems to me that that is an illimitable position, profoundly dangerous to the First Amendment. I understand the temptation of it because the stuff may not seem terribly edifying.
I take it then it wouldn't make any difference to your argument if the commission had found that there's just no technologically feasible way of keeping this away from children at all.
Justice White, I think it would depend, and in this I agree with Mr. Toronto, on what was meant by no feasible way. That is, take skywriting.
I know, but my question, yeah. Let's just suppose that the commission had found that there's just no way of really keeping this away from, it just won't be just a few, but practically any child that wants to can get to this.
Yes,
I would think your argument would still be the same.
Well, I think the compelling interest in protecting children leads, as Justice O'Connor says, to a requirement of narrow tailoring, and that leads to an inquiry of whether there really is a less restrictive alternative. And in the rare case where
if there weren't a less restrictive alternative, you would think the law would be all right?
It might well be all right if large numbers of children could in any event get a hold of it. I was about to give the example of skywriting. There are some things that just by the nature of it, when they're up there, everybody can equally see them, and you can't filter out some people. But it is simply fallacious to suggest, as the government does, that we're dealing here with anything remotely of that sort. That is, all of the evidence about the hundreds of calls that came in came from a period when there were no FCC safeguards in place. The primary quotation they rely on in their brief is from Brent Ward, U.S. attorney in Utah, and he said that there were hundreds of calls from parents of minors who complained to Carlin's New York City telephone service. But those calls occurred without any safeguards at all. And if you ask what Brent Ward, their primary witness on this subject, testified before Congress, he said this, and we quote him at page 9 of our brief. The access code requirement, I'm quoting, the access code requirement and the screening option would dramatically reduce the number of calls from minors, almost eliminating them. It would be a very effective way to do it. That's his language. Now, the government says, but that's only because they have a compromised goal. The compromise, as Justice O'Connor suggests, is with the Constitution, with the First Amendment. They say, if you really have an unalloyed goal, then you can say that there is no less restrictive alternative. But the alloy that they would remove is the alloy of the First Amendment. That is, quite clearly, if you give any weight at all to the importance of not preventing adults from a medium ultimately indistinguishable from others, from having access to material that is protected as to them, then this is an overly broad law.
So how do you decipher what Congress did?
I think in an election year, in 1988, it's not too hard, Justice White, if you ask me that question, to decipher what Congress did.
I didn't say it was hard. I just wanted to hear what you had to say about it.
I think this was a politically popular measure to favor, politically devastating to oppose.
Well,
even though,
what do you think they had in? What do you think they tried to do to make it absolutely to achieve the impossible goal of ensuring that no child ever?
I think that what
they didn't care whether it was one child or 1,000 who could. Is that it?
They were frustrated, Justice White, because there was this long colloquy between the relevant administrative agency, the FCC and the Second Circuit, lasting for about 5 years, going back and forth. And it was in early April of 1988 that the Second Circuit finally came down in Carlin 3 and said, you've done it, you've solved it. Mm-hmm. Within days, Congress voted this flat ban.
What?
The hearings were held months before Carlin 3 came down. So Congress probably thought, if you ask me to speculate, that the Second Circuit was forever going to frustrate the FCC, and that it was just going to cut through all of the red tape, and since it didn't value this stuff much anyway, and since it thought perhaps that it knew what it was outlawing, although with Justice Stevens, I'm not sure exactly what it was outlawing.
Well,
self-defining. They just said, let's go.
Did they seek the views of the Communications Commission with respect to this particular piece of legislation?
Oh, yes. They
and
were
they,
told by
what
Diane
did they
Hillary.
Say? They recommend that it be passed?
They recommended that it was probably unconstitutional.
Well, Congress said not go that far.
Yeah. President Reagan, when he signed it, said, I'm not so sure that it will pass muster, but I'm going to sign it.
Mm-hmm.
I do think if you ask
what was their view of the when they presented their views, they said it might be unconstitutional. But what about How safe was did they say that there's a reasonably effective way of doing
it? Oh, yes. They concluded in their third report in 1987 that there's a reasonably effective way of doing it. And that report was before Congress when it had this law. Uh-huh. And the colloquy wasn't over whether that would be reasonably effective.
And did they testify before the committee?
I believe Diane Killery did, but I'm sure Mr. Toronto will have
that. And did they explain what they thought reasonably effective was?
I believe, agreed with Brent Ward that it would almost eliminate calls from minors. And these are calls. I do want to get back to the suggestion, Justice Scalia, that this is just a teensy-weensy bit short of completely unprotected. I don't think there's anything in the record that shows that. After all, the government says, at page 5 of its brief, that this criminalizes calls even when the message is only suggestive, not sexually explicit. Even when there's no prurient appeal at all, in an oral argument they say that represents, they think, a fair volume. To answer Justice Stevens, they go to the Pacifica case to say, well, what does indecent mean? Of course, Pacifica dealt with the Carlin Seven Dirty Words monologue. That wasn't erotic in the slightest. It was perhaps in terrible taste. It was more funny than erotic. It might have been gross, but it had nothing to do with heavy breathing. It had nothing to do with anything pornographic in the usual sense. The government concedes that this ban applies even if there may be serious value. Indeed, as one of the amicus briefs suggests, one of the commissioners of the FCC wondered why Ulysses sort of ever made it, because he doubted that it had serious value. This law is about as broad as one can imagine.
Mr. Tribe, if you prevail in your, or Sable prevails, and the indecency portion of the statute is struck down, does the FCC still have authority to proceed the way it was proceeding up through 1987?
I believe, Mr. Chief Justice, that the prior law would have to be reenacted to give it that authority, though they might find some more general statute.
Did Congress repeal the prior law when it enacted the 1988 statute?
I believe it replaced the prior law with the 1988 statute. But I'm sure that the prior law, which was a little bit like the law of New York in Ginsburg, it outlawed targeting minors, and it created a safe harbor if the FCC's regulations were complied with. I have no doubt that they would reenact that in a minute.
Can I come back to your point about, you know, how much really important stuff is covered by this? In the Second Circuit case, Carlin 1, the court observed that rather incredibly 800,000 calls per day were made to dial-a-porn, your client's service, colloquially called dial-a-porn, in the 1 month of May 1983.
It was quite a...
And 180 million calls in the year ending February 1984. Now, I don't think they called up to listen to the Carlin dialogue. I really don't. I don't think that's where the money is. I don't think anybody thinks
actually,
that's where the money is.
Actually, the numbers dropped off dramatically, and many people think that jokes are the next thing, and that people got bored with those kinds of calls. But the key point, really, is that if it is protected, as the government concedes, judging what its value might be is a treacherous enterprise under the First Amendment. One man's trash may be another's solace. These poor
homebodies. I never believed that at all.
You never believed that?
Never believed it for a minute.
The lonely, bored person afraid of getting AIDS? I mean, the fact is, Justice Scalia, I at first didn't take this as seriously as perhaps I should, but last year the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine reported that stifling graphic sexual materials may now take a toll in human lives in the current period. The government addresses that, and they say, well, we don't know if it's true. If it's protected by the First Amendment, the default position, when in doubt, should be don't suppress. Let me, in the very brief time I have left, yes.
Are you going to argue the obscenity case?
I was about to try to do that.
About to try to.
Right. Of course, the Miller case, the separate, entirely separable obscenity provision, draws on Miller, which involved a mass mailing thrust on unwilling people. And some members of the court would really, I think, be understandably reluctant to uphold an obscenity law where the interests of unconsenting adults and children are otherwise taken care of. But the key point about the obscenity provision is that even if you would otherwise regard the government's power of criminalization as broad enough to encompass obscene transmission to a consenting adult, the government has conceded that this law, because of the discretion of the phone companies, they can invite eavesdroppers from Salt Lake City on calls meant only to Los Angeles. This law puts pressure on the companies to leave on the cutting room floor protected material, protected in the community where it is targeted, in order to avoid prosecution. And their whole answer is, hey, you don't need to challenge it now. Wait till you're prosecuted. The law is capable of valid application. That's a completely non-responsive argument.
Big chill.
It's the very big chill. And it's not just an overbreadth challenge. This operates like a prior restraint. It really does. That is, what's left on the cutting room floor, because otherwise someone will involuntarily ship it to Salt Lake City, will never expose you to prosecution. And they've never responded to that.
Is it correct, Mr. Tribe, that your client has been able to reach agreements now with Pacific Bell to offer purely local service in the Los Angeles area?
Would that it were quite as true as the government suggests at page 22 of its reply brief. What is correct is that proposed tariffs are in place with the California PUC. It's completely up to Pacific Bell whether to live with them. And their current proposal says, we might do it, but we will not allow you to collect any revenue for these local calls. Well, that's not exactly a settlement. That is, they might allow carrying local calls, purely local, which they would exclude from eavesdropping from across the country, but not transmit any of the revenue generated thereby to Sable.
Well, I guess your client could also hire people to answer the phone calls and screen them out.
It could use a completely live method altogether, but,
yes.
But I suppose you could say of records that people sell, they could also use live singers. But this is a separate, distinctive channel of communication. And the government's position that they can shrink it to what is fit for children knows no limiting principle whatever. And whatever one might think of the great or small value of this stuff, it seems to me that the First Amendment is in the balance and that it ought to prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tribe. Mr. Toronto, do you have rebuttal?
Just a couple of brief points that I think focus on the heart of our dispute. First of all, it cannot be consistent with what this court held in Ginsburg and reiterated in Pacifica that the point of sale is simply irrelevant to the inquiry. If the congressional and state legislative concern ended with the proposition that minors can, through a variety of means, pick up copies of Playboy magazine in their friends' houses or what have you, then the whole proposition and ruling of Ginsburg would be defeated. The significance of the point of sale is that it represents, in most cases, a very reliable opportunity to make sure that minors are screened from the audience. What is distinctive about the telephone medium, as was distinctive about the broadcasting medium, is that that is simply not possible. One additional point, and that is, we think it is at the very least important in focusing then on whether Congress did adopt a less restrictive alternative, in addition to giving deference to Congress's and the Commission's judgment about precisely what kind of access children would have, to ensure that the court does not strike down a ban on the strength of a less restrictive alternative that the Second Circuit found unconstitutional in Carlin III, and that Sable itself would continue to challenge as unconstitutional. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toronto. The case is submitted. We'll hear our